Okay, welcome once again to the series Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, sponsored by Becky Navi Katz, Eli Nishmas Yonah, Ben Rabbi Aryeh Leib. Tonight we discuss Chacham Avadri Yosef. When you're known simply by a title, and a generic title at that, it means you've achieved a level of renown that is unique. When Ashkenazim say the Gaon, so we all know who we're talking about, the Gaon Mivilna. In our part of the world, we say the Rav, and everyone knows what you're talking about. In our generation, especially now, when people refer to Maran, everyone knows that referring to the Chacham or Rav Avadri Yosef. He's a genius with a photographic memory, with a fearlessness and an iron will that made him a strong leader, and he was a force in Jewish life for almost 60 years. What kind of genius was he? Well, his tshuvos were encyclopedic, referencing dozens of sources on both sides of an issue, but dozens. And these sources were not gleaned through the Bar Ilan CD. He was the Bar Ilan CD before it came into existence. He would write or dictate a tshuva. He would ask in advance for the svar to be brought to him by the dozens off his shelves. He had a library of 40,000 volumes. He turned to the right page, get the right citation, and move on. And many of these sources were obscure, especially to Ashkenazim. So he would quote Sfardi Poskim, and for many Ashkenazim, it would be our very first exposure to them. What kind of memory did he have? I heard a story a couple of years ago. About 20 years ago, they brought the box of Seamus from Egypt. Fragments of Svarim written by unknown Egyptian Gedolim, and he had been the Abbasin in Egypt for a number of years. They brought random pages, about 20 different pages, isolated pages that did not have on them either the title of the Sefer or the name of the author. Of 19 or 20 of these random pages, he was able to identify 17 of the authors and the name of the Sefer, and this 50 years after he had last read them. He had a fearlessness and determination that surely made him controversial in many quarters. He only served as chief rabbi for 10 years, but essentially he never relinquished the role. Usually chief rabbis fade into the background to allow their successors to make their mark, like ex-presidents traditionally did until Jimmy Carter. But Chacham Avadri was the standard by which others were measured, and he was the one who had to give his approval. He remained, in essence, the ultimate authority through sheer force of personality and Torah greatness, and he cast a long shadow over all of his successors, great men nonetheless, like Rav Mordechai Eliyahu or Shlomo Amar, and until now, the current chief rabbi, his son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef. He did not mind ruffling feathers or staking out controversial positions on issues. And his influence was enormous. Of all the rabbis in this series, he was the only one who started a political party and a movement called Shas that graces or plagues Israeli politics until today, depending on one's perspective. The mix of Torah and politics is always volatile, it's never smooth, and that's because Torah, it's not because Torah has nothing to say about politics. On the contrary, the Torah is a political document in the sense that it endeavors to influence and shape public policy and not just private life. But modern politics requires compromises, deal-making, sometimes shady deal-making, requires abandonment of principles, even temporarily, and of course, the pursuit of lucre, money, and lots of it for one's cherished causes, and it's easy to see why Torah can be sullied in the process. And that happened as well with Shas, too many of whose leaders and public representatives have gone to prison for bribery and other crimes. So why did he do it? We can summarize Maran's life's ambition in one phrase that he regularly used, that in fact became the Shas slogan, Lachzir Atara Liyoshna, to restore the crown to its former glory. We'll have to understand what that means. It would not be inaccurate to state that Chacham Avadja had a chip on his shoulder for a good part of his life, did not appreciate the Ashkenazi establishment, struggled to overcome an inferiority complex that many Svardim had. He lamented the way the secular Ashkenazim had spiritually destroyed a generation or two of Olim from Eidot HaMizrach, and his mind, that had to change, and is really not wrong in his analysis. So we can disagree or disagree with his approach, but his diagnosis was right on point. Eidot HaMizrach were mistreated, even discriminated against. It's no mystery why they first became politically powerful while Chacham Avadja was the chief rabbi. The Eidot HaMizrach swept Menachem Begin into power in 1977, and why Shas was launched in 1984, 1 year after Chacham Avadja reluctantly relinquished the chief rabbinate. So his influence looms large even today and will for decades. So how did he become Maran? How did he shape his times through his Torah and his personality? Avadja Seif lived a long life, 1920 to 2013. He was born in Baghdad, named after a paternal grandfather, Ovadia, who was killed in a pogrom in the early 1900s, and named also after the Ben Ish Chai, who was the Gaon of Baghdad, whom Avadja Seif would revere, and also later life challenged. So he was called Ovadia. His Arabic name was, of course, Abdullah, Abdalala, Ovadia, the same name. The family surname was Ovadia. All his siblings used that as their last name, but when they made Aliyah, the boy Ovadia did not want to be known as Ovadia, so he used his given name as a last name, meaning his middle name, Ovadia Seif. The rest of the family still used Ovadia as the last name. They made Aliyah in 1924, traveling almost 600 miles on camelback when Chacham Avadja was but 4 years old. And they lived in the Beit Yisrael neighborhood, Rehov Shmuel Anavi. And after his father, Yaakov, lost all his money in a bad investment, the father opened up a grocery store in the neighborhood, but the family was always poor, but really poor. Chacham Avadja studied first in a local Ashkenazi Talmud Torah, and he was acknowledged as a prodigy. He would learn when his classmates played. His Rebbe, Yaakov Meir Schechter, taught them not only reading, but also and writing and Chumash, but also science and math. One of his sons said that his father could multiply four digits by four digits in his head within seconds. All right, think about it. It's not, 2,000 by 5,000 that we could all figure out, but 5280 times 7820, that's a little harder. His mind was a calculator. He started learning Gemara at age 7. When he was 10 years old, he entered the preeminent Sfardi Yeshiva, Parat Yosef, then is now in a building overlooking the Kotel, under the leadership of the great Gaon, Chacham Ezra Atiyah, who shaped 100 years of Sfardi Gaonim. And among his Talmidim, classmates of Chacham Avadja, was Rav Ben Sion Abba Shaul, was Rav Tzion Levi, became the chief rabbi of Panama for many, many decades. They were all classmates. After a year or two, he's 12, 13 years old, his father took Chacham Avadja out of the yeshiva to start working in the makolot. That was the company, that was the custom of the time. They'd learn and they'd go to work because that's what the family needed. This greatly distressed the young Avadja, and even more, Chacham Ezra, the Rosh Yeshiva, who went to the store to implore Yaakov the father to send his son back to yeshiva. When Yaakov demurred, so Rav Ezra Atiyah removed his coat, put on an apron, and said he would work for 2 hours instead of the young Avadja, who he told the father, if he was allowed to learn, would become a world-class gadol. With that, the father relented, and he allowed Avadja to return to yeshiva in the morning and work in the afternoon. And that soon ended as well, for the best of reasons. As his brother Naim Avadja tells the story, Ovadia Yosef would sit behind the counter and open up a sefer when there were no customers in the store. Alas, his inattention attracted shoplifters. And when the store began losing money and merchandise, his father sent him back to yeshiva full time for the good of the business. And the rest is history. Interestingly, most of his siblings are traditional but non-observant in a very classical Israeli Sephardi way. He's the only one who remained religious, so his brother Naim became Shomer Shabbat again later in life. As a child, he impaired his vision, learning by moonlight, such that for much of his life, he tried to protect his eyesight by wearing sunglasses, even indoors, as you see in the picture, became a classic look. Whether it's medically indicated or not, or there's another story, that's for others to decide. So he learned in Parat Yosef for over a decade. When he wasn't in yeshiva, he frequented Sfarim stores, where he became a familiar figure, perched precariously on ladders, studying, meaning memorizing Sfarim. They did not have in the yeshiva that were kept on the upper shelves. He would stand there balancing himself, just learning for hours on end. At age 15, he made a list of the 16 Sfarim he planned to write. At 16, he began teaching Torah publicly. And at 17, he published his first Sefer, a commentary to Horios he called Yabia Omer, which is based on the Pasuk, we say it on Pesukim de Zimra Shabbos morning, Yom Liyom Yabia Omer, but it's an allusion to his name backwards, Yabia Yud Bet Yud Ayin, backwards, Ayin Yud Bet Yud, Ovad Yosef Ben Yaakov, his name. And that name, Yabia Omer, he later attached to his primary work of Tshuvos. His first job, age 17, was teaching the Ben Ish Chai at a shul for Iraqis in Geula. He was hired by Rav Kaduri, the famous Makubal, and Rav Kaduri fired him when Chacham Ovadia, as a teenager, ruled in favor of the Beit Yosef against the Ben Ish Chai. So Chacham Ovadia, we'll see a little later as well, Rav Yosef Karo was Maran, and he was Mar Datra of Eretz Yisrael, and he refused to concede. And he stood up to Rav Kaduri, and this is how he sees the Psak, and he's not retracting. Shortly after, he began teaching in another shul for Persian Jews, and he began a lifelong closeness to the Persian Jewish community in Israel, in New York, in L.A., and even in Iran until the revolution. As a young man, he never got involved in the political turmoil debates of the time. His brother, Naim, was a member of the Irgun. He was even involved in the King David Hotel bombing. And a few years early, he came late to Chacham Ovadia's wedding because he was out attacking British soldiers, even though his mother had pleaded with him not to be late for the wedding, take the night off. In 1944, Chacham Ovadia married Margalit Fatal, who was the daughter of Avram Fatal. She was a Syrian, born in Syria, made Aliyah at age 12. It wasn't an easy shidduch. On their first date, he got lost in thought about a Gemara he was learning and had no idea what she was talking about, nor that she had asked the question to which he was awaiting his response. So she told her father, "This is not going to work." He pleaded for a second date, at which they walked and talked for hours, only interspersed with three shiurim he gave on three different topics in three different places, all the while as they walked and she accompanied him. He just said, "Let's stop here, I have to give a shiur." An hour later, they picked up a conversation, he did it three times. When they engaged, he told her that whatever merit he would have in Torah, he would share with her equally. Masada Kiddush was the chief rabbi, Rav Uziel, who also gave smicha to Chacham Ovadia. Together they had 11 children, sons and sons-in-law, all rabbonim in one way or another, including today, the chief rabbi of Israel, the chief rabbi of Cholon, the chief rabbi of Harnof, his son-in-law is one of the chief rabbis of Modi'in, Rav Chikotai. She, Margalit, died in 1994. They had a daughter who died at 3 months old in 1955, to be followed less than a year later by the birth of twin daughters. And one son, Rabbi Yaakov, who died 6 months before Chacham Ovadia did. So he was the Rav of Givat Moshe, but he had been estranged from his father for a variety of reasons. including differing with him on certain piskei halacha. He had opposed his father, for one, on the propriety of surrendering land to Arabs. For the last 20 years or so of his life, he lived with his son Rav Moshe Yosef in Har Nof on Rehova Kablan. And for whatever reason, he came from nothing, but he died with an estate in the millions, and he left most of the estate to that one son, Rav Moshe, with whom he lived for years. And naturally, as Minig Yisrael, that dispute wound up in court and might not yet be resolved. After the wedding, he was barely 24 years old. Rav Uziel asked him to join the Beit Din Yerushalayim, and that began his career. The young couple lived in a one-bedroom apartment. They could not afford electricity. Used kerosene for light till it ran out. Their oldest girl, now well-known in her own right as an educator, Dina Bar Shalom, slept in her mother's bed. When the second son, Reb Yaakov, was born, he slept at first in a fruit crate. It's about the right size for a newborn. Why people buy cribs, I don't know. Their financial situation did not really stabilize until 1947, when Chacham Ovadia was recruited to be Rosh Yeshiva and Av Beit Din in Cairo. So oddly, he spent the War of Independence, Muhammad HaShichrur, in the land of the enemy, in Egypt, with all the hardship that entailed. And he was hired to try to stem the erosion of that ancient community. He did not really succeed. By this time, the community was what we call traditional. They wanted a religious functionary for Kiddushin, for Gittin, but they were less interested in Shabbat, Kashrut, and Mitzvot generally. So he taught. He forged a close relationship with many, many students. He influenced the adults, sometimes by the young. In the Art Scroll book, they have an interesting picture of him wearing a fez, surrounded by about 20 of his students in front of the pyramids on a class trip. But he ran into constant battles with the leaders, with the even the religious establishment. He banned the use of microphones, which were common on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurim, and which even the chief rabbi was using. When a Christian diplomat died and the chief rabbi was unavailable and sent him in his stead, he refused to attend the funeral because it was held in a church. And in both cases, he wrote long tshuvot, delineating all the sources, and in both cases, he drew the enmity of the Jewish Community Council. When he tried to rectify the corruption in Shechita, some of the Shochatim paid an Arab to have him killed. Unfortunately, they mistook a pious Shochet for Chacham Ovadia, threw acid at him, and the Shochet was able to turn away at the last second, only suffered burns to his neck and back. If I was him, I would take that as a sign that this might not be the place for you. But nonetheless, he forged ahead. The Jewish-run hospital in Cairo only served tray food, unbeknownst to their patients, who were mostly Jews, and the Jewish council refused to change it. And after working behind the scenes was unsuccessful, he went public on one of the big days of the year, Shabbos Zohar, be a big crowd. And the outcry from the people was great because they didn't know they were being served treif. The enmity of the council, their hostility was even greater. And eventually Chacham Ovadia had to resign, and he returned to Israel less than a year after his resignation in 1950. Back in Israel, he began giving shurim again, and he interacted with the great Ashkenazi rabbis of the time, Rav Pesach Frank. They had a relationship going back to the 30s already, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Shmuel Rozovsky of Ponovich, Bezal Zolti, also from Yerushalayim, and others. As one impediment, he didn't speak a word of Yiddish, which somewhat encumbered him. But he was authorized officially to be a dayan, and he was invited in the early 1950s by Rav Reuven Katz in Petach Tikva. That's a famous name for all of us, the father of Michal Katz and Leon Katz of Pesach, a grandfather of our own Avi and Nadine Katz, live in our neighborhood. Reuven Katz was the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva, invited him to serve in the Beis Din, and he didn't last long there either, but only because he preferred to live in Yerushalayim. He soon published a sefer, his first real sefer, called Chazon Ovadia, on the laws of Pesach, and people bowled over by it, including both chief rabbis. But nonetheless, some of the Iraqi rabbis were ticked off because he ruled against the Ben Ish Chai. Some that year even burned his book with their chametz. But his Rebbe Rav Ezra Tia sent word to him by way of comfort, your sun has already begun to shine and these people are just blinded by its brightness. In general, Chacham Ovadia was not attuned to the Ashkenazi style of learning, especially the Briska Derech. And the Sephardi style, Ad Hayom, generally favored learning Gemara, Rishonim, and Acharonim to ascertain the Psak Halacha, as opposed to the classic yeshiva approach, where psak is the least of it, they produce beautiful svaros. Since they were more practical than theoretical. By the same token, he rubbed some of the svardim the wrong way, because he always paskin like the halacha when it conflicted with Kabbalah. And he was not afraid of making enemies, as we saw both in his earlier stay in Israel and in Egypt, or taking on critics. Now, among the criticisms was that his works were encyclopedic, but not very deep, meaning he'd prove an argument by saying 15 people held this way versus 10 the other way, without always weighing fully the relative merits of each position. But the breadth of knowledge was astonishing. As his public profile grew, so did his influence in the world of halacha and public psak. So he participated in a conference of rabbis in the Shvat of 1950. I think he's only 30 years old. Big conference, early years of the state, to unify the communities. So one law should apply to Ashkenazim and Sephardim, especially on issues of marriage and divorce. And both chief rabbis, Rav Yitzhak Isaac Halevi Herzog and Rav Ben Tzion Meir Chai Uziel, signed on. And for the most part, Sephardic customs were minimized or outlawed. And that galled him. For example, it was ruled, and this Rav Herzog writes in early in Hechel Yitzhak, he has the whole proclamation, Kiddushin and Nisuin had to take place simultaneously, which is common for us. Less common go to Mizrach then. A bride younger than 16 years old could not marry. Always married younger in the Dora Mizrach. Bigamous marriage was outlawed unless both chief rabbis signed on to it, and Yibum was banned in favor of Chalitza. We'll get into that in the greater detail in a moment. They banned weddings during the 3 weeks. Years later, Chacham Ovadia ruled, nope, Svardim can marry up to Rosh Chodesh Menachem Av. That's what the Beis Yosef says, and that in fact is common practice in Israel today in the Dor HaMizrach. Chacham Ovadia participated in the deliberations but was not enthusiastic about the outcome, and here began to crystallize his long desired goal of Lachzir Atara LeYoshna, to restore the crown to its former glory, to elevate Sephardic Psak as the equal of, if not superior to, Ashkenazic Psak. The first chance he got a year later, 1951, a case came before him in Petach Tikva, and against the ruling of both chief rabbis and the new Minhag HaMakom, he permitted a man to attempt to marry his brother's widow. And that's the first case in our source sheet. Number one, it's in Yabia Omer Chelek Vav, Evan Ezer, Simon Yudalid. And to get a flavor of what his world was and what his struggle was, we'll look at this in some depth. It's 1 through 3. It's Chodesh Tammuz, Tavshinaf, it's the summer 1951, Petach Tikva. Masa Bali Adena Veit Adina Yisrael Pub Petach Tikva, case came before us. Echad Marlei Teiman, Shinafla Fanaveshet Achiv Liyibum. A Yemenite immigrant came, his brother died, childless. He wants to marry his wife's, his brother's widow. Vahura Tzarakli Abeim, he wants Yibum. Vahayavama Einachaf Eitzabo. She doesn't want to marry him. She wants chalitza. So you think then it's an easy case just to adhere to the psak of the chief rabbis. wait for a case where both the man and the sister-in-law want to marry. No, he says, "Lo tam savir l'sirova l'tyabem lo." She had no good reason to refuse his yibum. He said, "I had a chance to now contemplate the new ordinance of the chief rabbis, dating back to Shvat of Tavshin Yud, meaning it's a year and a half earlier, signed by both chief rabbis, that said as follows." It's the bold Berov Kilot Yisrael v'chei b'Kilot Ashkenaz v'Eretz Yisrael kibul alayhem l'alcha kedir ramasha pasak.
He said, most communities in Israel, and certainly Ashkenazim, accept the psak of the Ramah that chalitza takes precedence over yibum.
V'gam shesh kisha shneihem hayavam vayavamar atzim biyibum eminichem otam liyabem.
Even when both want to marry, we don't allow them.
Since it's clear that most men today will not have in mind lakiv shem achiv, to uphold the name of his brother, just wants the woman or his money.
And because of the ways of peace, that we should have unity in the Jewish people, not make the Torah to two Torah.
The fichach harenu gozrim al toshav Eretz Yisrael v'ele she'alu v'yitivshim Eretz Yisrael me'atom me'achshav v'hola l'sar aleihem l'gamri mitzvat yibum.
So now, for all those aforementioned reasons, we decree nobody should be miyabem chayavim l'chalotz, and if the man does not want to give chalitza, then the basin has the right to assess him his zonot, support for the wife, until he does. And this is his extent. And he asks, at the few lines later,
"V'hine anu asfardim v'no mizrach v'teiman ki balno leinu haraot rabotein Rambam Martin Shulchan Aruch."
We're done a mizrach. We follow the Rambam, we follow the Shulchan Aruch.
"She'sovrim shalacha kechachamim shemitzvat yibum kodemet l'chalitza."
We hold the yibum takes precedence over chalitza.
"Af bizman hazeh."
So why then should we listen? Does it therefore have any force? That's the question. And he goes in the very long tshuva you see in the little letter vav. He says, most Rishonim hold yibum still takes precedence over chalitza. The Shiltos, the Rif, the Ram, the Raiv, the Rashba, the Riva, the Ravan, the Itur, Rabbeinu Yeshaya, Rabbeinu Avraham Ben Ahar, Ramah, Meir, Ramban, Rashba, Ra'ar, Ritva, etc., etc., etc.
Lachain, the bold, Lefi Anias Daiti, Lo Tzadku, Bozerishon, Tzion, Rabben Tzion, Uziel, Chachmeh Asvardim, She'imo, She'natnu Yadam, Lahaskima, Lahaskama Zob, Levatel Agami Yitzad Yibum.
He says the chief rabbi and the Sfardim with him, when they signed this agreement, they did not act properly.
Neged dat kol rabotenu asher mipim anu chayim emem anu shotim.
The Gemara says, chalitza makom yibum lav mitzvah. When you have a chance to chalitza, to yibum, chalitza is not a mitzvah.
And he says that in our b'kamot sheish b'atei din kfuim shal Ashkenaz kaim v'shirisal atra d'rambam mar umaran ein lana lazud midivrem yomin asmol.
When you have a based in kavu in Israel, Eretz Yisrael is the domain, the jurisdiction of Maran Beit Yosef, Yosef Karo. We can't depart from him.
Shebechon yonah yisur v'het onogam k'met shesekekorat Maran.
In any matter, yisur v'het, we hold like the Shulchan Aruch.
Shelo k'min agashkenaz musan alpiyat datz aramah.
L'shach b'zelot esgoni. He goes on to say, quotes voluminous authorities, that when Ashkenazim do one thing and Sfardim do another, that's not los esgoni do. If you go to number two, the top left, he says that they did what they did for Darkei Shalom Vachdut, but b'mchilat kvod Torahtam hifrizu al midah bazeh.
They exaggerated.
Vein divrayim nechonim klal.
Their words are not right.
Maisim b'chol yom.
They're separate shchita.
They're separate laws of kashrus, Ashkenazim and Sfardim.
And he says a very famous phrase, I'll say again and again, that Hasfardim kedat maran hamechaber Shulchan Aruch.
Sfardim follow the Beis Yosef,
v'Ashkenazim yotzim b'yad ramah.
We read on the Torah next week. V'chol Yisrael yatzim miyad rama parshas b'shalach. Yatzim miyad rama with a hey. But his slogan, Ashkenazim go up miyad rama, like Ramash of Isserlis. What does that have to do with us when it comes to how we pronounce tefillah? The nusach tefillah. Each Eidah does its own thing. Ve'elu ve'elir l'kim chayim. And he says in 3 that the Rishon Letzion, Rav Uziel, mitoch rov avatel achdut huma, because of his great love for unity and to remove the barriers between the Eidot, he even gave up Shechitas Sfaradit Yerushalayim. And here, Rav Tzvi Pesach Franki says, oppose this. And he insisted, no, Sfaradim have to have their own Shechita because that's their Kashrut. So he goes on to say at the end, the very bottom, L'chein gam b'nidon didan, yesh l'bein adin l'ashpi al ha-yavama l'askim l'vakashar ha-yavam l'tyabeim, k'dei l'kim shemet al nachlato. He said, up to the Beistin to try to persuade the woman, the widow, the sister-in-law, to marry the Yavam. This, think about it, this guy's 31 years old, it's Keneged, the chief rabbis, and the entire rabbinic establishment. Again and again, he would find occasions to exalt the poskim of the Eidot HaMizrach, even if it meant going his own way. And to make it even clearer, look at number 4, the bottom right, this tshuva, it's a question whether we say a bracha achas me'ein shalosh, I'm sorry, me'ein sheva, Friday night, which is Leil Pesach. See, he says someone had permitted Hare Maran Zal, Rav Yosef Karo, Hayamora de Kula Ara de Yisrael. Rav Yosef Karo is the Mora de Asra of the land of Israel, and we cannot deviate from his psak at all. When we speak of Lachzir Atar Al Yoshna, what's the crown? The crown was Rav Yosef Karo. And the superiority of the psak of the Eidot HaMizrach. In fact, he resigned after a short time from the basin in Petach Tikva to protest the refusal of the other Dayanim to use the Sfaradic spelling of names on Gittin for Sfaradim. 4 years later, Reuven Katz brought him back and gave him full control over Sfaradic Gittin. Now it's interesting, he didn't always hold like the Beis Yosef, and you can see lists of examples where he differed. So for example, we know that in Sfaradic Kashrut, they don't rely on the heter, the kul of the Ramah, that Bishul Akum, that it's enough if a Jew turns on the fire or adds a match, adds the smallest thing to the fire. No, the Beit Yosef held that the Sardim, a Jew has to do the cooking, otherwise Bishul Akum. Here he disagreed with the Beis Yosef, and he permitted Sfaradim to rely on the Ramah's kula. Other examples like that. In a general sense, he also believed that Sfaradic psak was less rigid than Ashkenazi psak. He's probably right. He says that Ashkenazim lost the sense of kocha de hetera odif. That's preferable, if possible, to be lenient than to be strict, because they, Ashkenazim, had to fight battles against assimilation that was largely unknown in the Arab world. So it doesn't mean he was always lenient, and many times it depends on your point of departure. For example, he maintained the Sephardic prohibition against wigs for married women. Is that stringent or lenient? Depends where you're coming from. He held that Shabbat ends Rabbeinu Tam time. Lenient or stringent? He held that glot meat was mandatory. He quoted the Chidah, who wrote Chidah from Maran Beit Yosef until Chacham Ovadja. The Chidah is really the authority, right in the middle. And the Chidah wrote, Hasfardim ochazim b'midat ha-chesed, or achuzim b'midat ha-chesed, Hasfardim are gripped by the attribute of kindness, l'chein hem mekilim b'halacha, so they're lenient. V'ashkenazim achuzim b'midat ha-gvura, l'fichach hem machmirim b'dinim. Ashkenazim are gripped by gvura, by strength, by might, and so they're more machmir. He said it in a less salutary way. He said Ashkenazic poskim had yirat ha-hora'ah, fear of paskening leniently, because they were not sufficiently proficient in shasu poskim. That's why they were too stringent. And interesting also from a sociological perspective, Sephardi authorities could be lenient because they never faced the threat of non-orthodoxy. Adayom, there's no such thing as non-orthodoxy in any Sephardic community. So they never feared, as you find in 20th century Ashkenazic poskim across the board, that if X is permitted, like a bat mitzvah, for example, which is halachically neutral, if you permit X, which might be mutter, then Y and Z, which are definitely also, will inevitably follow, so therefore prohibit X as well. Sephardim never had to contend with that. There was no such thing as non-orthodoxy. There was non-observance, but there was not non-orthodoxy in the sense the creation of an ideological, philosophical movement that was heretical or antithetical to Torah. Of course, L'achzir atar l'yoshna was not just an attempt to prioritize psak of the Don Mizrach, it was even more the desire to redress the grievances that Sephardim had against the Ashkenazi establishment and discrimination and abuse, and to rebuild the pride they naturally had that was stripped from them when they made Aliyah in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And it's hard to talk about. Too often Ashkenazim downplay what happened as just a tragedy of a clash of cultures or first encounter with modernity, and especially because it was perpetrated by the socialist heroes who founded the state. Nonetheless, by today we know the outrages. People with centuries of piety were compelled to eat treif because they were put in ma'barot and not serve kosher food. Their children's simanim, peyot, were just cut off. Women's modest clothing was confiscated from them. And they were told, we don't dress like that here. Children were sent to secular schools. And in the worst outrage, of course, the reports are rampant, but by today credible, that Yemenite newborns were taken from hospitals, sold as adopted children, sometimes out of the country, and their parents were told the children had died and already been buried, grave unknown. And these newcomers had nobody to talk to. Now, allegedly, there's even the government admitted this a few years ago, the labor establishment wanted olim, but they didn't want religious olim who would undermine their hegemony. So they had olim that had to be secularized or worse. And so two, maybe three generations of Sephardim suffered, and the legacy of dysfunction is still present. And despite all the reports and all the investigations, including 2 years ago, the true story has not yet been told in full. Now, Chaim Ovadia came to reverse all that and give the Dodah Mizrach a sense of the grandeur of their history. He would do it through halacha, through the force of his personality, and ultimately through politics as well. So he was never Rosh Yeshiva. Instead, he was a Magid Shir who preferred to teach simple Jews and young people in addition to serving in various rabbinical capacities. And he knew exactly how to speak to common people, to draw them in, to tell stories. Some attended his lectures for decades. When he came to Tel Aviv, it was in Yerushalayim still in the 50s, he gave a shir, and as part of the shir, he would serialize a story. He would tell them 10 minutes of a story, like 10, 20 part story, but only one part. They'd come back the next week. And this is how he got people to come to the shir. It was his weekly Matzoi Shabbos shir at the Persian, later Bukhar and Shul Yerushalayim, where he would speak off the cuff and make occasionally statements the media perceived as outrageous. But his day was filled with giving shiurim to groups large and small, and he would travel the country to convince Sephardim to send their children to religious schools. And interesting, in today's Wall Street Journal, I think I saw it there, they did a study of Trump's first year and his speaking patterns. And he rates the lowest of any president the last 70, 80 years. He speaks to people on a fourth grade level. All right? One above him, like a fifth grade level, was Harry Truman. And at the top of the list is Hoover and Carter, who have in common, they're one-term presidents, correct, with failed presidencies. To be able to speak to people on their level, I mean, it is what it is. You speak to people on their level, they develop a bond with you because they know you're not trying to act supercilious. That's how he spoke to his people as well. Not on a fourth grade level, Rahman al-Islam, but in a way to which they could easily relate. In 1954, he published his first volume of Responsi, Abiya Omer. He used money that his wife saved up to buy a closet. She gave it to him very willingly. And it cemented his reputation in the greater Torah world. It won prizes and would be the harbinger of dozens of Sfarim. He would write, I think Yabi Omer is 13 volumes, Chazon Ovadia series, another set of Truvos, Yechaved Das, was based on snap answers he gave to questions raised on a radio call-in program he did in the 1960s. His grasp and his range were astonishing. Later, son Reb Yitzchak would publish a series entitled Yalkut Yosef. It's like another Shulchan Aruch with his decisions on a wide range of topics. 1960, he returned to Yerushalayim to serve on the based and headed by the Tzitz Eliezer of Oldenburg. 5 years late, elevated to the Beit Din HaGadol, pushed by, among others, Rav Eliyashiv. He was only 44, and for the first time since Egypt, he had a livable salary. 1969, after much contentiousness and delayed elections, he became the chief rabbi, elected chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, to serve alongside Rav Shlomo Gorin. Now, Rav Gorin didn't actually take office for several years. He didn't want to resign as chief rabbi of the IDF. But for the first time, when he became the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he wore the glima, the robe, and the mitznefet, the turban you see in front of you now, for which he would become famous. He wore a more elaborate one. This is the more elaborate one when he became a chief rabbi. He began visiting and giving shiurim in all the shuls in the city, an exhausting schedule. Every Shabbat, every weekday, 3-4 shiurim every day to every shul he could reach. Another example, or two examples, or three examples of his sensitivity to the Ashkenaz Eidat HaMizrach divide: during the first year, he reviewed the city's handout for Pesach, and he changed one line. The handout always read, "Rice and beans are prohibited. Ben Svardim have a custom to eat them." And he said, "I'm not signing that. It's false. It's a distortion of halacha." They said, "What are you talking? We always had this." They said, "No, halacha is rice and beans are permitted, and Ashkenazim are machmir not to eat them." And so it was. It was changed. That was the halacha clearly stated. Look at number 5. This is from his first writing. It's Chazon Ovadia, and you see the anguish. So the case was, the wines in Israel were diluted, 1 in 6, one part wine, 5 parts water. But the halacha of the Beis Yosef, and that's mutzvah Ashkenazim, it's still considered wine. But the Beis Yosef holds, it has to be 1 in 3. He found this out, and he made an announcement that Ashkenazim cannot say a bracha, bar pergof under this wine, it's a bracha levatola. The badats here, natnu michshol, they're causing a stumbling block when they give a hechsher on this wine. Someone went to the head of the Badats and said, "How can it be that you are causing Svardim to stumble?" Look at the bottom, underline. Veheshivlo, Bachotemet HaBadats Katuv. He said, on the stamp of the Badats, it reads, Badats Lachom Mikilot Ashkenazim. It's Badats the Ashkenazim. Veinachariot HaSvardim Aleinu. We're not responsible for the Svardim. Now, obviously, people buying food don't see that or don't know it. V'tamehani ma'od al ha'atshuva zo im nemar mipek hadosh. You said, "I'm astonished that such a holy mouth would say such a thing, because l'chora, he's like indirectly causing Svardim to sin. And that can't be." And all these things he changed. More than that, look at number 6 on the other side. So the question was to use what Rav Gorin called Nusach Achid, the unified Nusach, which was mostly Ashkenazi, or to change Nuschos. And he's quite clear, quotes the Mabar Yabok, this is Yechaved Das, Chayla Gimel Simon Vav, L'chol achad mishnei masar shiftei Yisrael, yesh chalon achad berakia, kevi b'chinat nishmat shifto, asher dako nichnes tefilto. There are many different Nuschos in Tefillah. So the Ma'avar Yabok writes, it's because of 12 tribes, each tribe has its own window to heaven, and so each tribe has its own nusuch. You can't change from anything that your fathers did. Whoever changes, he's in the inferior position. And then skip down a little. He says, they quotes the Arisa the same thing. If the tefillos were all equal, the same, you wouldn't need 12 different gates. You have 12. And then, skip down a little more. After he quotes the Chida, if you daven Ashkenaz, you have your one gate. If you daven Sfard, that enters every gate. That should be the general one. Nimtzel Rabbeinu Ha'ari. Afal pi shemutal Ashkenazim l'shanel l'nusach Sfarad. Even though Ashkenazim can change nusach Sfard, mikom makom ein l'sfardim l'shanot nuschatam minhag Ashkenaz. A Sfardi cannot change to Ashkenaz. Note where he's going. He says, of course, the nusach achid that Rav Garen drafted, it's completely invalid. Vosakein ain't tefillah teretzia. A person, a svardi who davens nusach achid, his tefillah is not desirable. Veinu mikabel lemal, it's not even accepted above. And Ashkenazi can daven svard. Svardi cannot daven Ashkenaz. Ad kedei kach. 1972, elections were held for chief rabbi. Under a cloud of controversy, for the first time, insurgents ran against incumbents. Until that time, really, you served in the position until death. Here, Rav Garen took on Rav Isser Yehuda Unterman, and Rav Garen was the overwhelming favorite of the secular establishment because he had presided over a number of unusual and contentious cases. One, the Zeidman case, he converted a reform woman convert who had sued for citizenship under the law of return, granted her a quickie conversion to end the litigation. And of course, the Langer Mamzerus case, which we discussed here a few years ago in the Great Decision series. To have Rav Garen in power frightened much of the Torah establishment, so they persuaded Rav Unterman to run for re-election. He was a youngster at the time of 86 years old. In fact, he died in 1976. I was actually at his funeral. He was buried in Sanhedrin. Rav Unterman ran, but Rav Unterman did not have a good working relationship with the Rishon LeZion of the time, Rav Yitzhak Nissim. So if both were re-elected, there'd be continuing paralysis in the rabbinic establishment. So Chacham Avadia was co-opted to run, which he did reluctantly. He wrote a long tshuva explaining, justifying why it's allowed for him to run against Rav Nissim. He entered the race 2 weeks before the election, did not campaign. He won. In the end, Chacham Avadia was elected 81-68. Rav Garen was elected 89-57. And the two had a very, very short period of cooperation, followed by a decade or longer of enmity, the extent to which is hotly debated. Chacham Avadia, like much of the rabbinic world, disagreed vehemently with Rav Garen's psak in the Langer case. In fact, that psak led, in essence, Rav Elyashiv to leave the rabbinic establishment. He had been chief rabbi of Ramla and the Beit Din Hagadol. He left that and just went to the Haredi world. And the two of them, Chacham Avadia, Rav Garen, were not on speaking terms for almost their entire tenure. In fact, they had separate inauguration ceremonies because they couldn't be in the same room. The law was later changed to grant each chief rabbi one 10-year term. When it came to Psak, Rav Nissim and Rav Garen were more in sync. So in effect, he had a candidate of the right and the left, each one. Chacham Avadia was urged from the beginning, even cajoled by the labor establishment, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, to be lenient, to find a way to kasher the Langer children at a government reception to greet the new chief rabbis. Chacham Avadia said, really stated what his position was, Kocha de Hetera is preferable, but Halach is not determined in Kikar Dizengoff. It's determined in the Beit HaMidrash and by the Shulchan Aruch. If something can be permitted, it will be permitted. If not, not. When Chaim Avadya refused to join Rav Gaon on New Beit Din to free the Langers, that ended their relationship, and they conducted their business separately. And there was business to do. The end of the first year, 1973, found Chaim Avadya dealing with the consequences of the Yom Kippur War, and he was put in charge of finding solutions to the problem of Agunot after the war. Almost 1,000 women, some IDF soldiers had disappeared, but most of the Aguna cases involved bodies of soldiers that were burned or destroyed beyond recognition. So he was placed in charge because Rav Gaon's decisions would never again be uniformly accepted. And if you just want to see the tone of what's happening, what he dealt with, and he would spend literally nights, he wouldn't sleep for days on end, trying to find heterim for each case, allow the widow to remarry. Look at number 7, Tziabia Omer Chelek Vav, Evan Ezer Simon Gimel. He writes, Hoshiena Kelecha Inenu, Bikveld Melchamei Yom Kippurim, Nitbakashti, was asked by the two chief rabbis of the IDF, Mordechai Peron and Gad Navon, Lashevet Yacharitam, Berosh Beit Adin Linei Agunot, Kadei Ladun Vesog, Bekarov Le'elef Tikim Shachalitzal, Kadoshim Hashem Kom Damam, Hashem Nesum Vishir Acharem Almanot Zirot Liyamim. Almost 1,000 cases of young widows after the Yom Kippur War. And even though Dekim Liben Avshai, he says he knows, Katonti Me'od Miladun, Bedina Erva Chamura, and certainly Eishes Ish, he's too young, too humble, too small, to involve in these weighty cases. V'Nafshi Odat Me'od, Gol Acharet Shebedavar, Kaveda Le'adavar Me'od, Mikotza Masig Me'od Me'ka Musag. Nonetheless, he accepted it, and he knows what has to be done, and he mentions at the outset, that's the Pasuk in Koheles, Shlomo said, Reisi Demata Shukim, I see the tears of the oppressed. That's the case of Aguna. Vein lahem minachem. V'chomi shematir Aguna achat bizman hazeh, hilu bana achat mechavrad Yerushalmi Elyona, latzir b'china achat, me'eshet chayil. And he quotes a Shus Yaakov. He has a case where they took Eidus on Shabbos before a Beis Din from a person who was critically ill, who went to free an Aguna, did not want to wait till Motzei Shabbat. In fact, he dealt with Aguna cases his entire life. Sometimes, again, if he was onto something involved research of facts in them, psak, he would once told his son, call the woman, it was 2 a.m., call the woman and tell her we're able to free her. And his son said, want to wait for the morning, he's probably sleeping. And she said, no. He said, no, the pain, anguish of an Aguna, trust me, she would want to be awakened to hear the news, so call her. In the end, he found heterim, so there was no Aguna after the Yom Kippur War. And of course, a lot of the formula that he developed was used after the Arab terror on September 11th and the destruction of World Trade Centers as well. He found within a year and a half, or 2 years, every Aguna was allowed to remarry. He declared the immigrants from Ethiopia to be Jews, 1973. And of course, each decision was backed up by voluminous sources. He was asked by Prime Minister Rabin during the Entebbe hostage crisis to convene a council of rabbis to determine the propriety of caving into terrorists versus a rescue mission. Council debated, but had no conclusion. They were debating when, if you look at number 8, you read about the whole thing, Yabia Omer, Chelak Yud, Choshe Mishpat, Simon Vav, there's the end of the tshuva. He discusses their deliberations, and then he says, V'nei b'taseif, Roshay Om, G'dalei HaTorah, Ladun, B'nasei HaZem, M'chinat HaLacha, U'v'toch K'dei HaDiyonim, Shetor B'tzidei HaLacha, in the middle of our deliberations, he gave Rosh Hashanah, Mar Yitzchak Rabin, Eleinu, he gave us the joyous news. The Anshei Tzal come, they destroy the terrorists, freed the people. And it's very moving. Involved in that as well. In almost every area, the two chief rabbis were automatic opposites. That's not to say because they were such antagonists, but invariably happened. If Rav Garn permitted ascending Har Bayit, Chaim Avadya was against. Rav Garn drafted the Nusach Achid, Rav Avadya was against. Rav Garn wanted to change the text of Nachem after the Six-Day War, the city is no longer degraded, Chaim Avadya was a traditionalist. Rav Garn opposed the Land for Peace delusion, Avadya Yosef supported it, and this became his primary and somewhat distorted legacy for left-wing secular Israelis. So 1979, at the height of the negotiations with Egypt, Carter, Camp David, etc., Chacham Avadya stated as follows, wrote, Im Rashei Mufagdei Hatzava Yachem Chavrei Memshala, if the leaders, the commanders of the army, together with members of the government, Yikavu Sheyesh Pikuch Nefesh Bedavar, they determine that it's saving lives, Shem Lo Yuchzur Shtachim Eretz Yisrael, Kayemet Sakanat Milchama Miyadid Mitzad Hashchina Arvim, if you don't return territories, there exists a present immediate danger of war from our Arab neighbors. And if they give back the territories, this danger of milchama will be distanced. There's a chance even of a lasting peace. It appears, according to all opinions, it's permissible to return territory for the sake of this goal. Nothing stands in the way of saving lives. And it was reiterated, this is number 9 on our sheet, his 1999 letter in support of the Y Memorandum. He wrote to my good friend, Mar Binyamin Netanyahu, Hareini balechazek et yadecha binyan telechashav, come to support you. Remember in Y, the second paragraph, they turned 31% of Area C into Area A. They give up Hebron, or Hebron was given up before. He says he got reports what the government is doing. Lidati hadavar chashuv ma'od la'amik et ha'shalom l'kadeim holo. And he says at the end, v'ani mevarech otcha shetamshich b'derech hazod v'lo tir atamek shayim mibayit u'michut sakruchim b'kach. You should, God bless you, continue on this path. Don't be afraid of the hardships from within, without. Well, about 25 years after his first statement, he essentially retracted opposing further surrender of land after the Oslo debacle, and that's number 10, his 2003 statement. Birtzani lehavhir emdati minyan Yesha, Yehuda Shomron, Gaza was Gaza as well. Lo pam izbarti mikvar ki psak halacha shenatati bizmano shtachim tmat shalom. He said for a long time already that his psak that supported territories for peace, eino tokef klal, is not in force at all. Leregel amatzav anochachi, in the face of the current situation. Ani et kavanti ach v'rak l'shalom emet. I only meant a true peace. Bo Yerushalayim v'sviotel yishkinu avetach, in which Yerushalayim and its environments would dwell securely, b'shalva v'shalva, ulam atah, but now, einen ra'ot v'kalot, ki adarabba, misirat shtachim me'artzeinu k'dosha, goremet l'sakanat nefashot. Now we see the opposite, that handing land to the enemy causes danger to life. Lola shalom kazeh yichalnu, lola nar zed palanu. This is not the peace we expected. Lefichach heskem aslo batel umuvutal. I think Abba said the same thing today. The Oslo agreement nullified and void. Kenishom v'chadaber heima la milchama. And he bitterly opposed the expulsion from Gaza in 2005. Pikuach nefesh, to surrender the land would be pikuach nefesh. Well, alas, the damage was done, and really done permanently, because the government used in 1993, not to mention 79, his haskama in order to engage in those processes which were harmful. So it's good for a posek, a Torah authority, to get involved in politics if he's right, not if he's wrong. Because they've tried to run from that now all these years. You ask the average supporter, and all they mention is the 2003 statement. They don't mention the 79 statement or the 99 statement. I was once asked, I used to give a seminar to young rabbis. They said, should a rabbi play ball with his congregants, baseball?
So I said, only if he could hit, which was a very good answer. All right, it's the same thing here. If you're going to be right, then talk. If you're not going to be right, then it's going to cut into your Torah as well. The term limit law enacted in 1978 precluded Chacham Avadra from seeking another term, and that became a very complicated scenario. So he had been elected in 78, and they just extended his term again, 78. But then with that, with another five-year term for him, Rav Gorin, they said that's it. So he was succeeded by Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who disagreed with Chacham Avadra on a number of fundamental issues, a big posek as well. Rav Mordechai was totally opposed to surrender of land, totally opposed. But Chacham Avadra never really relinquished the role. He still was introduced as a Rishon Letzion, still wore the glima, this is just a few years before he died, still was seen as the preeminent posek, and this is perceived by some as an irritant. His predecessor, Rav Nisim, had receded into the background, as did Rav Unterman. So this was new. What was even newer was that Chacham Avadra created a permanent platform to ensure that his views would be heard and that his life's work, Lachzir Atara LeYoshna, would continue and expand. So unprecedented in Israeli life for Chief Rabbi, he created his own political party as a personal vehicle, a party he called Shas, classic ethnic party. Now Rav Shach encouraged him and later regretted it. They had a falling out because the influence of Shas soon greatly surpassed that of the Lithuanian yeshivish world. So his initial interest was focused on Torah, reforming, improving the Sephardi educational system, and it worked to some degree. The Elamaya network, a robust effort to enroll children, Sephardi children, in these Torah schools. There's always been discrimination in Israeli schools against Sephardim. Many Ashkenazi schools maintain quotas. It was true then. Sadly, it's true today as well. Today, often in all streams, including the Haredi system, they'll limit the number of Eidonim Mizrach or Ethiopians, and they'll attribute it to all sorts of reasons, but it's disgraceful. It still exists, but Chacham Avadra created a party that would strengthen Torah and Sephardi identity and pride. It also strained his relations with the Ashkenazi Torah world, like Rav Shach and some of the other postmen disagreed with him. Clearly, for 30 years, Chacham Avadra was the dominant religious personality in Israel. The problem, as I noted earlier, is that a political party has to deal in politics, which usually involves corruption, especially financial. So the primary figure who talked Chacham Avadra into this party was an ex-Ponovitch student named Aryeh Deri. So he would later serve 3 years in prison for bribery, like a number of other Shas personalities. In all, in the last 30 years, 6 Shas MKs, members of Knesset, have gone to prison for bribery and other crimes, more than any other party. Now, they would claim prosecutorial bias, and they might be right. There might be bias, and they also might be crooks. That's not necessarily contradictory. And Shas became a magnet for government money and a conduit for funds to people and institutions, some but not all legitimate, as well as a prime purveyor of patronage, jobs to its supporters as chief rabbis of cities and towns, bureaucrats and the like. Deri became and is a master at manipulating coalitions for financial advantage of Shas, and he remains a major power broker, knowing how to play the right off the left and the left off the right. So it's fair to recall, despite the antipathy of the typical Shas voter for the Oslo Accords, those agreements only passed because of Shas in the government. Shas passed Oslo, and they could never run away from it, despite all their anti-surrender talk, even anti-Arab talk. The money would only flow their way if they voted accordingly. Now, all politics is like this. When politics becomes so intertwined with Torah, the Torah seems less pristine. It's not as tamima as it should be. Chacham Avadra later claimed that Deri tricked him into supporting Oslo. Who knows? The money Shas obtains from the government, in theory, supports its network of schools,
as well as extensive social service programs, but in all, it's given Torah a black eye. Shas began with 4 seats in 1984, rising to a high of 17 in 1999 with Derry in prison, and now has 7 seats and is dwindling. Last election, after Maharaja died, they appealed for votes by advertising, "This is how Maran wants you to vote. And if you vote for Shas, you'll be rewarded from heaven. And if you don't, the opposite." So they've tried to sit in every government, right and left, succeeded in all except for once, and they adjust their principles accordingly. So with his death, the party's fortunes have really declined, but it's a mixed legacy. So is this. Chamavadze knew how to be provocative, and he became great copy for the secular media once they had no use for his support for Oslo. He gave for decades a public shiur every Motzei Shabbos that for decades and broadcast on the radio. They would monitor his every word routinely. He was the first person I noticed this happened to. It's happened to others as well. They single out the one word or phrase they find offensive. And the older he got, the less he seemed to care what the media thought. So he made statements about the victims of the Holocaust, IDF soldiers who were killed, about Arabs, about women, about non-Jews. A slew of politicians he would curse in very colorful ways. Many statements were taken out of context. Many were just quotes from the Talmud or the Kabbalah, the Zohar, that flew over the head of the secular reporters. And many were just his manner of speaking. He was usually speaking to a very sympathetic audience of Eidot HaMizrach, and he spoke their language, which can be very flowery, shrill. It could sound harsh, even crude to outsiders. Hey, even presidents sometimes speak like that. But to insiders, it was biting, but very humorous. Today, it's a sport, monitoring every word for the one thing someone will say in a discourse of 2 hours that will further offend the perpetually offended. He would occasionally apologize or clarify, but he didn't seem to care much and certainly never changed. Whatever can be said, his love of Jews always shone through. He was always peppering his shiur with stories that appealed to the common man. He would greet people, especially the young, but even the not so young, by slapping them on the cheek. He became famous for that. And not really play taps, they were slaps. But he meant it as an act of love. And with this we close. He was a complicated, multifaceted individual, but at his core was Torah. His essence was Torah. His day was defined by Talmud Torah. 15, 18 hours a day. Once he climbed a ladder in his study to retrieve a sefer for a tshuva he was writing, and he was so excited that the source agreed with him that he turned and ran back to his desk. Alas, he was still on top of the ladder, so he fell to the floor and fractured his arm. But he lost himself in the Torah. That was his love of Torah. His tshuvos number in the thousands. Yalkut Yosef is highly influential today. It's very readable from his son, and there are books by the dozens written by him. His wife Margalit died in 1994. It changed his life. He remained active, influential, and beloved almost until the very end. As his strength ebbed in the weeks after Sukkot in 2013, a vigil began, and he died Gimel Mar Cheshvan 5774, just 4 years ago. He was buried in the cemetery in Sanhedria, right near the entrance, not far from Rav Unterman, in fact, about 20 yards from Karen's grandparents. His funeral was probably the largest in the history of Israel. Maybe 800,000 people came to his funeral on just a few hours' notice. His critics said only 500,000 came, not 800,000. He died shortly after his son, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, was crowned the Rishon Letzion. And with that, the revolution that he wrought in Israel, in the Torah world, and in the Eidot HaMizrach, continues until today. His political power might have waned, but he remains a Torah force that will be reckoned with for generations to come. I thank you all very much.